This woman is brilliant.
She's brilliant.
Do you think she would want to be my friend?
I want to be hers.
I want to be her friend.
I call all, well, you call all your books
all
your
my
friends.
Books are my friends. So she is my friend because I read her work. Welcome to the Desert Voices podcast, spiritual conversations about thriving in the desert. I'm Shalene Kendrick.
And I'm Holland Fields. We spark curiosity and boldly explore spirituality to contribute to human flourishing.
This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you resonate with our work in the world, would you consider supporting us on Patreon or with a tax-deductible gift through Allegro? Information is on our website at desertvoices.com.
It is also wicked helpful when you subscribe to our podcast, five-star review us, and share episodes that touch your heart.
Let's get curious.
Let's get bold.
I'm like, it's so good. Bleh. Season two. You all, we are doing this. Mm-hmm. Season two, here we go. Welcome back to Desert Voices. We are so glad that you are here and you are a part of the conversation. This is a place where your voice matters. On this episode today, Holland and I get to interview our theological star crush, Dr. Paintner.
Yes. And Dr. Paintner really helped us to frame our first few episodes in season one in her book, Desert Fathers and Mothers.
So go back to season one, episode 1, 2, and 3. We dive into Dr. Paintner's work within those episodes.
And what I really have loved and learned from Paintner is that she believes in the revolutionary power of stillness and spaciousness and really of practicing the presence of life's unfolding.
I love that so much, Holland. I talk often about, and as I finish seminary, this idea of becoming and the idea of practicing the presence of life's unfolding is practicing the becoming, that we are in constant state of becoming, a constant state of evolution and transformation. And to speak to Brian McLaren's work, he has this beautiful resource that we make the road by walking. And that is so much to what Dr. Paintner's work speaks to.
Totally.
And she also believes in radical hospitality. And I am so captivated by this idea. She talks about radical hospitality, both to the inner and the outer stranger. I'm fascinated by the idea of understanding that we are even strangers to ourselves.
Yeah.
Then she goes on to talk about the way and the ways in which the monk's path matters in our world of division, in our world of speed, and a world that is addicted to productivity.
Oh, yeah. And along with the great writer Dostoevsky, that's a good last name.
Dostoevsky.
But Paintner believes, along with this writer, that beauty will save the world. She's a poet, but I think that that's true. She writes, "I believe that when we tend to the birthings in our hearts, we cooperate with a divine creative force at work, always bringing something new into the world or new into being." And we speak about this in season one, episode 6, in the labor of new beginnings, that we get to co-create and bring new life into this world.
And we are going to have an episode with poet, spoken word poet, and hip-hop artist Micah Bournet. And he also talks to this idea of beauty and poetry saving the world. Yeah. Like, one of the quotes Bournet has is, "Speak poetry to evil." And I can't wait for you to listen to that episode as well. But this is who Jesus is. Yeah. That the life of Jesus is so beautiful and so captivating that the beauty of Christ's life does save the world. And that is so much why we need artists and poets. It's why art matters within our world. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Paintner also goes on to say that she believes that all of life is an ever unfolding journey.
Yeah.
So back to that idea of life is a process of becoming. So buckle up, join us for this episode.
Yeah.
You are going to absolutely fall in love with Dr. Paintner as well. And we can all share the same theological crush. Hello.
Hi. How are you both?
Oh, we're good. Dr. Paintner, we're so excited to meet you. We're gonna fangirl a little bit, if you don't mind.
That's very sweet.
Well, your work has been so meaningful to both Holland and I, especially as we both shift in our faith and our spirituality. We use your book. We know we're not supposed to do this, but kind of like a guidebook. We're like, okay, we're doing good. We're not alone. Dr. Paintner's here with us, and she's telling us about all the ancients that have been here with us.
Yeah, it grounds us, helps us know we're not alone. So thank you.
Lovely. I like how you're both sitting in front of a door. It's very intriguing.
Well, if you saw the room around us, we're both in closets.
We're both in closets. Yeah. We laugh about humble beginnings. We're like, yep, we're both like sheltered in a closet for the best sound. And it's good. It's really good.
Very good.
All right. Most importantly, how can we address you? We love addressing you as Dr. Paintner because you're obviously a badass intellect, but what is most comfortable for you?
I am totally fine with Christine. So, but I mean, you know, yeah, I appreciate the formality to start, but it's, yeah, it's totally, Christine is perfectly fine.
Perfect. We would love to know more about your journey. That we know, we love, we've done quite a bit of research on you because we're, again, fangirling. But we love how you talk about yourself as a poet, a hermit, and a mystic. And we'd love to know, what does that mean to you? Tell us your spiritual journey within those lanes.
Those are some pretty wonderful lanes to be driving in.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I didn't grow up in a religious household at all. My parents were kind of agnostic and atheist. But I think I always had that longing and I always had a love of the arts. And I grew up in New York City, but my parents loved going to museums and old churches. And so there was very much that sense of the aesthetic that shaped my early imagination and my sense of what might be bigger than what I am or, you know, what we are. And so, yeah, I think really, you know, I went to graduate school thinking I was going to become an academic, but I instead I discovered how much academia felt really stifling to me. I did teach for a few years at a university, but ultimately my work in spiritual direction and retreat facilitation and all of that, I really loved that sense of companioning people and that kind of intimate relationship that you get that's different than, I mean, I think education and teaching is important work, but I love that sense of entering into a relationship with people and journeying with them along the way. And also obviously me discovering things along the way as well. Being a Benedictine oblate has been really significant for me. So that means I'm a lay person who's made a commitment to a women's community in the North Pacific Northwest, and I try and live out the Benedictine rule as best I can in my everyday life. And yeah. The desert mothers and fathers were a huge influence on how the Benedictine rule developed. So, and moving to Ireland, the Celtic way, the Celtic imagination has also been really shaped heavily by the desert monks. And so
yeah.
I feel like that's kind of the root, the root of it all. And then it sort of flourishes in all these other lovely ways. Yeah, I think the sense of pilgrimage has been important in my life on different levels, both physical pilgrimages that I've been on. I've done a lot of ancestral work, journeying to places that my ancestors were from. Even living in Austria for a while, which is where my father's buried, is very much an ancestral journey. And also seeing the pilgrimage as this more kind of metaphorical principle, and particularly, you know, in times of struggle and loss, like when I've lost my parents or when I was diagnosed with autoimmune illness when I was 21. And, you know, that's been an incredible teacher of the desert way for me over many years. And all of those things, I'd say, have ultimately deepened my intimacy with the divine, even if there were places along the way where that relationship felt very far apart.
Yes.
Can I ask, like, for a glimpse into, like, a moment that was really impactful on one of your pilgrimages?
Yeah, there's a lot of different moments that come to mind. The one that's coming to mind at the moment is my father and I didn't have a very good relationship for the most part, and he was heavily addicted, particularly to alcohol and to gambling. And when he died, it was kind of a relief. But particularly when my mother died soon after, and I had a lot of emotional, grief and pain that kind of came from that, and which led me on this whole ancestral journey. And many, many years later, I went to Vienna, where I've been many times in my life, but I went to visit my father's grave. And every time I visited, it was always sort of like a reaching out across this divide and never feeling like anyone was reaching back. Yeah. But this one time, this was a few years ago, this one time I went, it was in May, and there was a cuckoo bird that was fluttering around from branch to branch. And I had never, ever in my life, and all the times I'd been to Vienna, had ever heard a cuckoo bird there. And so anyway, it kept going around and around. It was there for a good long time. And my husband was with me, and so he's witnessed that I wasn't completely crazy.
It's always good to have a witness.
I thought at first it was a clock somewhere, but it seemed kind of ridiculous outside. Well, anyway, just to say that was kind of like the first moment of sort of feeling like the someone reaching across the divide. A few years later, I traveled to Latvia, which is where my father was actually born, and had discovered all this information about my great-grandfather that I never knew. But anyway, when we were being shown around by this woman, she was telling me about the goddess Laima in the Latvian tradition, who is connected to law. And my great-grandfather was a lawyer. He was the first Supreme Court justice. But she mentioned that she's connected to destiny and fate and like the things that are called to us. And then she mentioned that she's connected to the cuckoo bird. And it was sort of this sense of like, you know, sometimes these synchronicities happen like years apart, but all of a sudden like time collapses and there's sort of this sense of like, oh. So for years I was wondering what the cuckoo bird was about. And I had all kinds of theories about what that might be, some of which might be accurate. But then there was like this whole other layer that kind of opened itself up and revealed itself to me about, intimacy and connection. And by that time I had some real healing experiences with my father. So
that's beautiful. That's very mystical. We've loved the mystics, and both of us have transitioned from a very conservative, fundamental, evangelical, American evangelical background into the stream of contemplatives and mystics. And one of the things I'd like, as you speak about this mystical moment with the cuckoo bird, we'd love to you, if you could define and maybe expand upon, when you say mystic, what does that mean to you? And part of why we're asking is, growing up, for us, mystics were akin to witches, right? Like, it was spoken about with disdain.
You don't go there.
You don't go there. You don't want to be a mystic. And so I just remember growing up going, whatever a mystic is, it sounds bad. But I could also feel that energy in my heart drawing me towards it. And so I hear you speak about this mystical moment with your father's grave and the cuckoo bird and your ancestral history. And it's like water to my soul. And so I'd love, like, you know, for those of us that are leaving evangelicalism and reframing our spirituality, can you help give us a working definition of what a mystic is?
Well, I think for me, the mystic is the person who, well, there's a couple layers of it for me. One is that you're always paying attention to what's beneath the surface. So so when you're opening yourself up to that mystical encounter, you don't just accept that life is only what you see on the surface of things, that, you know, those moments when suddenly, you know, the light shines in a certain way and you just feel this sense of opening to life, or, you know, a flower touches your heart, or even just a moment of kindness, maybe from the cashier at the grocery store, you know, and you're having a hard day and there's that moment of like softening. And so I think ultimately what that's all about for me is that the mystic sees that there isn't separation, you know, like Thomas Merton, you know, who talked about, you know, in his deepest experiences of prayer and solitude and silence, that he felt the most profoundly connected to all of humanity and all of creation. And that's ultimately, you know, it's not about retreating into some as much as I love being alone sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. We loved hearing about all your solid retreats, like solidarity and solitude, quiet.
Yeah, exactly. But ultimately, when people ask me, like, how do I know if I'm having an authentic spiritual experience or mystical experience? And, you know, basically what it comes down to for me is that if it leads me to deepened love for others and for creation, then that to me is a sign that you're encountering that divine source of love, you know, and that's what's flowering inside of you.
I love that. And I hear you saying too, like, learning to trust yourself. I hear you talk about, I listened to your beautiful podcast with my friend Cassidy Hall at Encountering Silence. And you so beautifully spoke to that inner knowing. The idea of, I've been working out with my therapist, the idea of belief comes from external information, which isn't necessarily bad, but we talk about having a lot of information about God. And I hear you talk about silence and encountering silence and the idea of this deep inner knowing and a mystic trust that inner knowing and trust that voice, trust the light that, you know, reflects off of a branch just so that you trust that that is the spirit of God, or a cuckoo bird reaching out to you from the other side, that that's the spirit of God. And I just love that. I didn't learn to trust myself growing up. So hearing you say that, you giving me permission to do that is powerful in my life.
Well, and I also hear there's this element of like curiosity, which we're obsessed with, but like, a cuckoo bird flies over and you could easily be like, oh, that was a beautiful moment, and then let it go. But like, how do you stay curious about it and let it open you up to new possibilities? I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I think for me, it's the sense that, you know, the world is a sacred text and that there's always a gift being offered. When I teach about Celtic spirituality, I often draw on the story of St. Kevin and the blackbird. And there's this wonderful story about how he's praying during Lent and his hand is stretched out. Well, both his hands are stretched out, but one is outside his little cell because there's no room for him. And in his hand lands a blackbird, and the blackbird starts to build a nest. And then the blackbird lays her eggs, and then, you know, he realizes he can't withdraw his hand at that point, and he has to wait for those eggs to hatch. And I use this story a lot about, you know, when I wrote in my book, Eyes of the Heart, about contemplative photography, is it the difference between taking a photo and receiving a gift. So we often like move through life with this grasping and this sense of like wanting to make something happen and forcing things and, you know, and all of that. And the mystical path to me is much more about opening up our hands and awaiting and seeing what actually arrives and learning to trust that that might be an actual gift from that divine source and letting that unfold, as uncomfortable as that might be, and, you know, not getting through our to-do list or not making something happen.
Yeah. Can you email us the link to that story so we can put it up on our website for our listeners?
Yeah,
we're a huge fan of being resources here. So your book is like highlighted on our website as one of the number one resources. Like, this is a must read.
Lovely.
That's beautiful. And that leads me to that idea of like, can you tell us more about desert spirituality? Like, what led you to study desert spirituality? As you define desert spirituality, what does that mean to you? And what is this thing in the desert?
Well, it's interesting because early on when I was in graduate school, I had to do this whole history of Christian spirituality exam. And I wasn't initially drawn to the desert monks. It was more the later medieval period. But essentially what happened was, after I graduated and I started doing some writing, I actually got an invitation from the publisher of that book, Skylight Paths. An editor asked me, would you consider writing a book on the desert mothers and fathers? She knew I had a lot of background in Benedictine spirituality. And I thought, this is something, like, sometimes those invitations come to you and there's a big grace in it for you. And I sometimes feel like I wrote that book as much for myself as I did for others. And I think I fell in love so much with the desert path because it is so much about living on the edges of things and It's one of the things that I'm really drawn to in terms of the monastic way is this idea of being an edge dweller. And one of the desert monks says, you know, happy is the monk who thinks he's the outcast of all. And, you know, that can be, you sort of think, why would I want to be an outcast or why would I want to be an edge dweller? And yet the monk for me is that archetype of, you know, that seeks out ways of being that are countercultural, that are, you know, life-giving as opposed to death.
Yeah.
That looks for, you know, that is the edge dweller, but is deeply connected to the center, that seeks silence instead of the noisiness of culture and can really listen in to those voices, you know, calls, is a call to slowness over speed and productivity, the idea of being instead of doing, you know, all of those kinds of simplicity over excess. So it's like that real countercultural pathway that I think we're really hungry for right now.
Oh my gosh, yes. And I love that idea of being an outcast. Holland and I say we're in those liminal spaces. So we're too progressive for the conservatives, but too conservative for the progressives, too liberal for the fundamentals, but we still are pretty too fundamental for the, you know, it's just that space between that does feel like an outcast. And that speaks to my heart of the knowing that that is what desert spirituality is about is beautiful and helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it speaks to why it's really important also to have a community of other monks, you know, whether it's one other soul friend, but someone who can help you stay true to that path and to know that that's actually what's most life-giving.
I love that.
What would you say to someone who feels like, I don't have that soul friend? Because I feel like Shalene and I have been like, oh good, we have each other.
Thank God you're here with me.
Oh, we're not alone. You know, but I don't know, where would we, what would we say to the person who's like, I feel really lonely in that?
It's a really hard thing, although these days with online resources, it does make it a little bit easier. That's one thing. With the community that I run, Abbey of the Arts, you know, we're a virtual monastery, so we have people from all over the world. And I think what people come, they're so delighted to find that they can find a kindred spirit, someone who's, you know, particularly drawn to this monastic way. And we also explore the intersection with the artist. And so for someone who lives like in some small town and maybe Montana, you know, they might not be any monk, you know, self-identifying monks and artists, but they can find that kindred community. So I'd say online is actually one of the first places I'd recommend, because it really does, you know, there's so many like sub communities that you can find your niche, you can find what makes your heart sing. But I'd also say like finding connection to creation, to nature. I find there a lot of solace in that. I also find a lot of connection to the ancestors and the communion of saints and feeling that sense of, you know, the love of thousands that brought me into being. And, you know, there's all these different layers to it. So, and of course you can find spiritual directors online these days too. So, but you know, and if there's might be a friend, like an in-person physical relationship that you have with someone that you've never talked with about these things, but maybe you could have that conversation and say, you know, would you be interested in exploring something with me? And sometimes we don't make something intentional, but just that simple act of naming that and opening that possibility can open the door to something really rich and fruitful.
Thank you.
That's important and powerful. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to this next question, this idea. I was so caught by your words in your introduction. And I said this in a previous podcast, but your introduction to Desert Fathers and Mothers, it's worth its weight in gold. I mean, it's profound. Like, I think I highlighted every single sentence throughout it. And one of the things that I loved more than anything was when you said the desert is not a place of personal retreat, but it's or encounter, but it's the place of spiritual revolution. Mm-hmm. And can you say more about that?
Yeah, it's, well, the desert is the place where we confront all of the securities and comforts that we desperately want to hold on to, and all of the idols that we make, and all of the images of God that we, you know, hold on to so tightly that it means, you know, we've kind of subverted everything else in our lives. So, you know, and oftentimes that desert experience comes through some kind of great loss, you know, whether it's a death of somebody, or a loss of a job, or a dream of some kind. And it's in that undoing, you know, if we can stay with that experience, and, you know, sometimes those kinds of undoings means we just shut down and we shut that off and put that out of our lives. But if we can let it soften us, and if we can discover that in the midst of that vulnerability is actually great strength and power, if it can lead us to recognizing how the divine is always so much more expansive than anything that we can imagine. It's all of those breaking opens, you know, and it's a lifetime. The other thing is, it's a lifetime journey. It's not like we have one desert encounter. We move through one revolution and then we're, you know, we get our certificate and move on.
I know. I wish. I say this often. I have a tattoo around my upper arm that reminds me the journey is the point. Because I so badly want to get to the destination. And you're speaking directly to that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think, in them, Benedictine spirituality, one of the commitments is conversion. And it's one of those words that I think a lot of people have a hard time with, particularly if they've left kind of religious tradition, institutional religion behind, because conversion has that more that sense of like converting others. But what does it mean if we make a commitment to our own lifetime conversion? So it's this commitment to always being surprised by God, to always being open to something else being the case, to, you know, not becoming cynical or narrow-minded about things, which, you know, in our current world scheme of things can be hard to do.
Oh my gosh. Christine, you just handed us a key, because we often think of conversion as ideological conformity and compliance. And I want nothing to do with that. So reframing conversion in this way is spectacular and so life-giving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has nothing to do with us converting anybody else, because really ultimately it's, you know, I talk sometimes about how, like, to me, orthopraxis is much more important than orthodoxy. Like, but what I believe, I don't actually care that much about what other people believe. It's how you actually bring that to, you know, action in your life, and how your own heart has been transformed, and how you've opened to the griefs and the losses, and how that you've let that change you to someone who loves more and more and more and more, you know, as opposed to someone who's become hardened by it or more rigid. You know, all of those things.
I love that. I'm a practical theologian, and so I'm not all that interested with your theory. I'm interested with how your theory, what is the lived impact of your doctrine? What's the lived impact of your theory? Mm-hmm. And it's been so helpful and life-giving.
That's wonderful. I love that.
Yeah, it's good. So, Dr. Christine, one of the things that we loved about what you said is you talk about your love for that word radical. Even in your website, you talk about radical justice. And I don't know if you've read this, but Sonia Renee Taylor, she has this beautiful book called The Body Is Not an Apology. It's, oh my gosh.
I haven't read the book, but I follow her on Facebook and she's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, it's spectacular. Oh. And it's so good. And she has this phenomenal, she defines the word radical in such a cool way. And she says, I mean, she just goes basically first to the dictionary definition, which is, and I'm just going to read it here. It says, the definition of radical is an ongoing root or origin. It's a fundamental radical difference. And it's a forming your basis or your foundation. And it speaks to changing. And I love that. So when we talk about radical justice, and then I'm also deep into Walter Brueggemann's prophetic imagination. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love, how would you pair those two together from your perspective? Like, tell me what radical justice would look like to you in our context, in our culture.
That's a beautiful question. And I love that you're bringing those two thinkers together. I love Brueggemann's, I love that particular book and his work on lament and creating that space for crying out to name, you know, what needs to be changed. And then how do we hold that in partnership with, you know, what is at the root of things? That's a beautiful question. I think it's, for me, it's about creating, like, we're always returning to that deep sense of love as the foundation of all. For me, that's like the heart of the mystical path. And this, I think that's where my heart breaks the most, when I see kind of contemporary, like the religious right and the United States in particular, and this sort of depiction of what Christianity is supposed to look like. And for me, it's so far away from what I experience as an invitation into a place where love is the foundation, where I'm called to hold space for mystery, to acknowledge that God is always so much more expansive than anything, you know, I can imagine, that I'm called to come face to face with my own limits and humility and mortality and all of those things as a way of cultivating more compassion in the world. So, I mean, I suppose the heart of it, the prophetic imagination for me, is, you know, how do I see myself deeply connected to all that is? And then how do I act from that in the most kind, compassionate, loving way? And can I, can I live a life that's truly mindful of that and let go of my need to control the outcome? I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's kind of,
it's beautiful. And, you know, I often think about how, you know, especially, well, the mind loves dichotomies, right? Like, it's this or that. And in part, to me, the work of a mystic and contemplative is to live into that gray space. And so I even think of, like, a monk is far away from the world and absent from the world, and an activist is in the world, actively changing the world. And I think that they're on two opposite sides of the spectrum. And I see your work and the work of many contemplatives like Rohr and Thomas Merton are bringing this contemplative activism. They're merging the two together. And I guess my question would be, what does contemplative activism look like in your life? Because you do have a deep commitment to social justice and a deep commitment to the way of the monks.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in my own life, I feel like my particular call is to be a teacher and a guide, to make space for others to enter into, you know, this desert journey, to offer the resources and wisdom as I can, and also continue doing my own work and, you know, continuing my own practice and my own, like, being fully committed to my own growth and to acknowledging that I have my own limits. And, you know, I think, so, you know, years ago I did the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, which is a year of volunteer work. It's a domestic program. And one of their mottos is that you're ruined for life, which I love that image. And I think for a long time afterwards, I wrestled a bit. I worked, you know, in a homeless shelter for a while. I worked with emotionally disturbed teens. And I wrestled a bit with, what does that activism look like, particularly for me, with someone who is especially limited in my kind of energy and ability because I have autoimmune illness. And I've come to see that, for me, that the contemplative path, this way of living in the world that is more spacious and slow and pays attention to those moments of inbreaking and gives voice to them through poetry and through writing, that is going to be my form of activism, in terms of that is my offering to the world of helping people see past the dualisms that you were just talking about. You know, how do we make space for that to happen? It's not something we can think our way into or plan our way into. It's more about how do you hold space for that encounter to unfold. And
I'm hearing, like, it's almost when you dive into being your most authentic self, that is true revolution and activism.
Yeah, that's a beautiful
idea. And we don't get to, like, plan out how that's going to go out and change the world, but trust that, like, this will move in the world with love. And
exactly. There's some wonderful quotes by some of the mystics, and I'm thinking of, like, Archbishop Oscar Romero, he has a wonderful long quote about, you know, how we we're not the master builders. We just do our one little piece, and that's all we can contribute. And there's a storyteller mythologist in the Northwest called Michael Mead, and he also has a similar invitation where he says, you know, we don't know that what we're doing makes any difference. We can't know that.
Yeah.
But we have to do it. Like we all were brought into this world with a particular gift to offer. Mm. And I can spend all my days wrestling with whether or not I should be doing that or not, or I can simply embrace that gift and offer it as freely as I can. And then just hope and trust that it will, you know, make some small impact. And of course, you don't know, like, the person you touch then touches other people, and they touch other people, and they touch others, and you don't know.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, what faith is really about, is sort of this, it's a trust, but it's also like, and you keep acting in the world as if what you did make some little bit of difference, and that you need everybody else to be doing their little bit as well, you know?
Yeah. It sounds like you're talking about the life of Jesus, right?
Like, imagine that.
Like, Jesus didn't write a book. He didn't record his sermons and podcast them out to the world. He never once started an organization, and he hung out in the lives with people. He had dinner with people. He retreated into the monastic life of solitude and silence. And that rippled out and effectively changed the fabric of the earth. And I think our listeners, I so deeply resonated with what you're saying, because as an Enneagram 8 and a very extroverted, fierce woman, I get into this doom mode, right? Like, how many organizations can I start? How much, you know, how much money can I fundraise, or fill in the blank? And I think those are good things, but you're like this voice of a siren calling me back to myself, back to silence, back to contemplation, trusting and believing that who I am and how I move through the earth changes the fabric of the earth. That my legacy is quietness in a lot of ways, and an internal change. And it's not building buildings with my big name on it, or, you know, it's just, you're speaking to the opposite of what the world believes.
Yeah. Thomas Merton has a wonderful quote in one of his books where he's writing to activists and ministers. And he says, you know, the more that we do, and the busyness is actually a form of violence that contributes to the violence in our culture. And I actually read that first years ago in a yoga magazine that was an article about nonviolence. And I loved that coming together of my worlds there, but that it really impacted me, because I really started to reflect on, you know, because as much as I am naturally a contemplative in a lot of ways, I do have at heart also a very doer side, and someone who likes to get a lot of things done and all of that. And so it really forced me to look at how I live in the world as an act of nonviolence, and how, you know, the patterns of rest that I can witness to. Are you familiar with the nap ministry?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But I like taking naps. So yeah. If there's a ministry out there, I'm in. I will be looking them up as soon as we hang up.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah. Because she very much, I'm blanking on her name right at the moment, but the woman who founded it, she really connects rest as a social justice action and creating spaces, especially for Black bodies, and, you know, that have been, you know, exploited for generations and generations. But, you know, I'd say the same thing is true for most of us, that we live in a culture that wants to exploit our labor and our energy to get as much from it as possible. And so anytime that we live in resistance to that, we are, you know, cultivating our own little mini revolution of rest, and letting people know that there's something more important than, you know, how much you achieve and what you do.
Hallelujah. A nap is an act of activism.
Going to bed early for me lately has honestly been my spiritual practice.
Yeah.
I have two little kids, and I'm like,
okay, that is the most holy thing for me to focus on rest, like physical rest in my life. And it bleeds out in my emotional rest and everything. And okay, we want to ask you a big favor, but would you give us a word that as Shalene and I continue to journey on Desert Voices, we resonate, everything you've said, we're like, yeah, we resonate with you. And this is the work we want to do in the world and invite others to join us out in the desert. And so I would just love to ask you for that gift of a word.
Well, first, I'll just say, you know, this idea of giving, give me a word in the desert is this beautiful invitation to chew on something for, you know, days or weeks or months. And it's very much not like the fast track to spiritual enlightenment or spiritual transformation. And it's not a linear path either. I think lately for me, sitting in this time of pandemic, and there's a lot of frustration, I think, for a lot of people who are, you know, feeling isolated and impatient and all of that. I suppose my word when I was praying about this image is, you know, what if we think of this time as an initiation and a threshold? What if we think of it as an invitation into the desert to both release all that is unnecessary, but also to enter into that space of unknowing, of radical unknowing, where we wait. We have to wait together in that sense of love and hope and faith for what the new thing might be that emerges. I think oftentimes we're kind of grasping at it and trying to make it happen. So my word to you would be to sit and wait and to let that be enough, you know?
Can you see into my soul? Because that... like anyone and everyone who knows me is like, oh, hell yes, Shalene needs that word.
I love that.
That's beautiful. Well, as we wrap up, we'd love to know, tell us about what projects are you working on right now? What are you excited about?
I am, well, speaking of someone who does a little too much, I have a lot of book projects. I have a poetry collection that just got released called The Wisdom of Wild Grace, which I'm really excited about, the second poetry collection. And next year I have two books coming out, one on sacred time. So very much about slowing down to kind of the natural rhythms of the world, and one on breath prayer. So one on how do we align our prayers with our breathing and deepen into that presence to all the ordinary activities. But I think the thing I'm probably most excited about right at the moment is we're creating a prayer cycle for Abbey the Arts. It's a 7-day series of morning and evening prayers. And it's based on the theme of a book I wrote this last spring called Earth, Our Original Monastery. So it's a free gift. So people, it's a podcast released as a like audio and video podcast. So people can pray morning and evening prayer kind of in the style that we use, which tends to be very inclusive and spacious. So
I love that. That's good. Can you give us a little recap of what Abbey of the Arts is, and then where can people find you and support your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, Abbey of the Arts is a virtual monastery and a global community. It started off as a blog, but has quickly become a community and place of connection. We offer resources helping people integrate contemplative practice and creative expression. That's kind of the meeting point. You can come to abbeyoftheArts.com and we have a newsletter. You can get it daily, weekly, or monthly, whatever your...
Yeah, I get it. I love it.
And, you know, we have like different gifts that come through that. We have a course on becoming a monk in the world. That's a free gift when you sign up for that. But we also have other online retreats that are what actually help support financially, you know, the rest of our work. Yes, there's lots of different doorways in there.
That's cool. I love this idea of online retreats. I want to sign up for that. That'll be my next step with you.
That'd be wonderful. You'd be most welcome.
Well, we cannot thank you enough for your time and saying yes to this. We know that we're small potatoes in the world right now. And it's just means so much to us to get to be with you and talk with you. And again, you're like the song of the siren to those of us that are moving quickly through the world. It's that anchor of stillness is who Jesus is. And your work really matters in the world. Yeah. And it matters to us.
Well, you both have just a gorgeous energy and spirit, and I have no doubt you'll be, that your work is rippling out in beautiful ways and it will continue to unfold. So I send you blessings for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Holland.
Yeah.
I can't believe we get to spend time with Dr. Painter.
Yeah.
I so resonated with a ton of what she had to say. Specifically, I resonated with how she defines a mystic.
I loved it. I thought when she was talking about a mystic a lot, and just in these moments of seeing things in nature or having these encounters over and over and being curious about them and engaging with them and trusting our inner knowing with this mystical process, I thought a lot about myself as a kid and how I would play and imagine. And I was a freaking mystic child.
Yeah.
I played fairies and witchcraft and potions and all these amazing, everything that I encountered during imagination was a divine sign and encounter. And so I just loved that. It brought me back to this place of even as an adult, when I see a butterfly or a bird fly by, that it can connect me back to my childlike self.
Back to the goodness of God, the heart of God. You know, my daughter's a mystic. Well, all of us are mystics. Yeah. But the other idea is encountering mysticism through your children. Yeah. And we call Layla a wood nymph, that she's always she is like an otherworldly creature. So I say I have three kids and a fairy. She's this otherworldly being. And she really does. When we're out in nature, she talks to trees. And one time she got in a fight with a tree and she kicked it. And I was like, Layla, what are you doing? She's like, I didn't like what that tree had to say. And I kind of look at her for a moment and I burst out laughing. And then she turned around and gave it a big hug and she apologized to the tree. She did. She goes, will you forgive me for kicking you?
Oh, and that's cute.
I loved it. So we love this idea that we hope that all of us don't over-spiritualize things.
Right.
But that we don't allow our adult logical minds to under-spiritualize them as well.
Yeah.
So join us in the way of the mystic.
Yeah. And we love this idea also of a pilgrimage. I've never been on a physical one.
We should go.
I know.
Let's go to Spain.
As she was talking about it, I'm like, I need to move my body and connect to something in the earth and the land. But this definition, the pilgrimage offers us the opportunity to encounter the stranger within ourselves, to journey to places which make us feel uncomfortable in the service of breaking something free inside of us.
Yeah, she goes on to write, the pilgrim's path matters in this world where we are encouraged to hold on to and accumulate comfort at all costs.
Yeah, it was this really bringing us back constantly to it's the journey, not the destination. Obviously, we're reaching a destination, but while we're on that journey, we get transformed.
Yep.
So
let's all become mystics and pilgrims. And then finally, Holland, she gave us a word. The desert fathers and mothers were these monks that lived out in the desert places, and people from the cities would come and tug on their robes and say, give us a word. Yeah. And we got to tug on Dr. Painter's metaphorical robe, and she gave us a word, and she gave us the word to wait.
Mm-hmm.
And also she said that word release, which, Holland, that's been huge for us lately.
It has been huge. I am looking, because every week we've been releasing a podcast and we're like,
stressful. Y'all, this is hard work.
My body reacts crazy.
Yeah.
I get these weird migraines. We're working on these things. But it's been interesting to step into this new journey. And so Shalene sent me the definition of what release was last week. And even though we're this is the mystical part, everything has this meaning, right?
Yeah.
And so we release an episode every week, but it has to be something more for us. So I'm looking for the definition that you sent me. Oh, here it is. To free from confinement, bondage, obligation, pain, to let go. To free from anything that restrains or fastens. And then to allow to be known, issued, done, or exhibited. Mm. And I love that, allowed to be known. We're going to release it out there and just be known right where we are in that.
Yeah. And it's to beautiful. Be freed from bondage and captivity. Holland, that's exactly what we do here at Desert Voices.
Yeah.
And so the word that Dr. Painter gave us is also for each one of you.
Yeah.
So every one of you listening, the word that we believe God has for us through Dr. Paintner is to wait and to experience release, yeah. to be freed from confinement or be freed from bondage. Yeah. And we're going to leave you now with questions to ponder that our content here at Desert Voices is bold, thought-provoking, and practical. And the practical aspect is that we want to leave you space and leave you some ideas for you to think about. So the first question is this: can you identify some mystical moments in your own life?
Another question is, what is the revolutionary action that you can participate in today, even right now? Maybe it's a nap. Maybe it's going to bed early. Maybe it's listening to a podcast that stretches you, or sharing a podcast, right, with someone.
That makes you uncomfortable. In fact, share our podcast.
Hey.
Join the revolution. Share the Desert Voices podcast with a friend.
Do it. But really, it's, for me, helping me understand that question is, what is countercultural action that I can step into? It may be uncomfortable, but that I know will nourish my soul. And that ends up overflowing and having these ripple effects of bringing love into the world. What is that countercultural action? It can be so small.
Right. And that is the way of the monks, right? Yeah. The countercultural action is to slow your life down.
Yeah.
And so we'll leave you with this. Think through, what is one thing in this episode today with Dr. Paintner that resonates with you? What's one thing that you can sit with, that you can write it down, that you can contemplate? We care for you. We're grateful to be on this journey with you and in dialogue with you. Welcome, and we'll see you next episode.
We'll see you later.
In the spirit of transformation, we reserve the right to evolve, change our minds, and make many, many, many mistakes.
For resources discussed in this episode, writings, and partnership opportunities, head over to our website at desertvoices.com.
Follow our work and engage with us on social media. Our handle is desertvoices_SC. We would love to hear from you and connect with you. We also would love to collaborate in a variety of ways. Reach out to us.
To support us and join the movement, it is incredibly helpful to review, subscribe, and share this podcast. You can also support us on Patreon. Until then, go
be free,
flourish.